Should Jonas try to steal O-Dog's seat the next time they're on Overdrive together? Yes or no? Keep it simple, stupid. A simple yes or no. I don't think O would freak out. I think he would plot your demise. He'd get you back at a later date.
I don't think you guys are right. I'm not going to do it. It's not nice.
I don't want to find out.
He's earned his spot.
Okay. All right. So you're going to defer to the hierarchy?
Yeah, like Jeff's that. Listening. I hope you heard that.
There you go. Deep down, Jonas loves you and respects you.
I think if he wears his Toronto Maple Leafs alumni blazer, that you always defer to him. But if he's not wearing it, speaking of things that he loves that alumni blazer.
My favorite is the Austin Matthews jersey, which he
while interviewing Austin Matthews.
Well, that's awesome.
Well,
hey Jonas, he's not playing straight up beat reporter here.
That's true.
He is. He's got the tattoo, man. He is a diehard Leafs fan.
Oh, he's a Leafs fan. I mean, don't you love the stories when he was playing for Carolina, and he would come back here for the playoffs, and he would go into the crowd and cheer for the Leafs? Like, I mean, he grew up a Leafs fan, and it never left him.
I wonder, I mean, it would have crushed him not to make the Cup Final in 02. But I wonder what he was really thinking heading into that series. I mean, we want to win. I want to win. I want to compete for the Stanley Cup. But if I have to lose in the Eastern Conference Final, I'm glad it would be to the Maple Leafs as opposed to any other opponent.
Well, because then he could cheer for them in the Cup Final? Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be in the city. Lose. Be back home. He'd be... I'm telling you, man, if... This is probably an obvious comment, but if the Leafs make a Stanley Cup Final at some point in the next 3 or 4 years, it should just be declared a municipal holiday for a week. A week to 10 days. Only essential services should be forced to work. And, honestly, sports media guys, because we'll have to be talking about it.
I don't agree. I think what makes the whole thing the crescendo of is the anticipation. You got to go to work, and you got to get through lunch, and you got to get things done. And at the same time, you got this wild imagination going on what the game's going to feel like. You're talking with your work friends and your colleagues, and you're, what about this? What about that? They lose, you come into work the next day. They win, you come into work. One of the great things that I found in the early 2000s is getting on the subway or the trolley cars after a Leafs game in the playoffs. And the mood was, if you'd come into the city and you didn't know if they'd won or lost, all you had to do was get on a trolley car or subway and you knew. And the excitement of winning and the disappointment of losing, that's what it's all about. You can't just give a free pass and say nothing's going on, essential services. You need that interaction.
You need the water cooler talk.
You do. Come on, that's what that's all part of the passion.
Yeah, well, I get it. I mean, Ray is a diehard Boston Red Sox fan, so I don't know if there's a hockey example for him, but we'll bring him on here. And Ray's appearance on Overdrive, as always, is brought to you by Valiant Financial. Ray, on the day of a big Boston Red Sox game, say it's a big game in the ALCS, World Series potential clincher, because you've experienced those now. What's that day like for you leading up to the game?
No, I can't wait for it to get started. I generally, if the Yankees aren't playing in the game, I call my brother to make sure that I tease him that his Yankees aren't in it. That definitely is part of the equation. I call a couple of Blue Jay buddies that love their Blue Jays and make sure they know that my team's in and theirs isn't. And then I make sure that I clear about 15 minutes at the start of the game so I can organize whatever mess needs to be cleaned up around the house. And then I can settle down into my spot to watch the game.
Okay, so game 7, 2004. Take us back to that day.
Yankees, Red Sox. Yeah, Cammy and I were out for dinner. And the meal wasn't going very quickly. And I was not in a very good mood. I'm like, I'm going to leave here pretty quick. And she's like, we got to finish. And I'm like, they got a doggy bag or something. Let's move it along. I would say I wasn't the best date.
No.
And the crazy part, guys, and I guess this is the only way I really relate to, like, Leaf fans or Canadiens fans, is because I don't cheer for my work. I just work. You know, I don't care who wins a hockey game. It doesn't matter to me. I don't think of it the same way. I was nervous all day. I mean, I'd been a Red Sox fan since 1975. And in 1986, I was certain that it was all over. You know, there was two out in the ninth and against the Mets, and then three straight singles, a wild pitch, a base hit, a ball up the line, and it's into game seven. I was certain that was it. I didn't realize it was going to be 18 more years, right? And so I was nervous. I'm like, what if they blow this one too? Because it's easy to say looking back, oh, I had confidence, but they've lost every other year. Why would they win now? Except they did.
Wait, Ray, what happened in 1975 that you became a Red Sox fan?
I was a Boston Bruins fan. Bobby Orr was and is my idol. I love the Bruins. And then around that time, the Boston Celtics were great. And so that was Dave Cowens and John Havlicek. And So I became a Celtics guy too. And then I started to play baseball more seriously. And in 1975, I was playing all the time. And the Red Sox had these two rookies that came in, Fred Lynn and Jim Rice. And Jim Rice, without question, was my favorite baseball player of all time. Loved the way he played. From 1946, I believe, until Jim Rice retired, they had three left fielders in Boston. Uh-huh. Ted Williams, Carl Yastrzemski, and Jim Rice. And my oldest son's middle name is James, and it was because of Jim Rice. So that's how I became a Red Sox guy.
That was a Carlton Fisk that series, right?
I want to say that was the first time I stayed up past 10 o'clock, you know, like on a school night. And they got in I think it was in the 10th, George Foster threw out Denny Doyle at home plate, and the game continued on. So that was a double play that, you know, it was a fly ball with one out, short field and left. It was over by the foul line, and Foster grabbed it, threw to Johnny Bench. And there was a great story about that game and about the broadcast of that game. And since we're all in this business, it is one of the most fascinating reads. It was all kind of happenstance the way it happened, the way the announcers were in the places they were, because they just had two-man booths. And after I think about the eighth inning, whoever was doing color went downstairs to do the interviews. And somebody else came in to finish the color analyst spot. It's an amazing read. Like that shot that they got was on a locked off camera. And it was almost by accident that they got one of the greatest shots in World Series history.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
So the Yankees win in 04 for you, Ray. We'll get into hockey here in a minute, I promise. But the win over the Yankees in 04 was so dramatic because the Sox are down 3-0. They storm back.
I can tell Scotty, I will tell you, Cammy and I were eating sushi. I look up and Dave Roberts steals that base. Uh-huh. In game four.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, well, maybe they'll win a game. Because by this time, I'm like, again, 3-0, my brother's calling me and he's giving me all kinds of crap. Like in 1978, when the Red Sox were up 14.5 games in July, that was a torturous 2 months because it kept getting closer and closer. And you just knew somehow those rotten Yankees were going to come back. And they did.
Yeah, well, and I think you guys had lost game three of that Yankees series, like 19-8 or something. So,
crushed.
Yeah, just crushed. Destroyed. So, but was the World Series against St. Louis anticlimactic? Because you swept them, right? So by the time game four rolled around, you must have been like, geez, this is unbelievable.
The only thing I was waiting for, honestly, at 3-0, you're like, they can't lose now. But there were so many places they could have lost. Like that Yankee series, three times that series should have been over, and it just wasn't. And there was some, you know, some great heroics. I mean, that was really the time that, that Curt Schilling's legend was built, and, you know, they ended up going ahead and against the hated rivals to come back and to, you know, to steal a series that shouldn't have happened. And so by the end, I mean, when they're flipping the ball to first base for, you know, that seemed like the series was over before it was.
Yeah. Well, pretty special when your favorite team wins, especially when it snaps a curse. I can vouch for that, 2016 with the Cubs, and man, was that ever a ride.
Well, somebody, by the way, last point, somebody said that the only way that this would have been more perfect is if the Red Sox and the Cubs had played against each other and nobody won.
Yeah, nobody, exactly. Yeah, just keep playing. Game 8, game 9, can't declare a winner here. It'll never end. What does it feel like, Ray, when you are as red hot as James Van Riemsdyk is right now as a goal scorer?
Oh, you can't wait to get out there. Every time you go on the ice, you feel like something's going to happen. And the you know, the 180 degrees from that is there are plenty of nights you feel like, man, the puck never comes near me. I'm just out here for a public skate. Like, I never get to touch the puck. Now Van Riemsdyk goes on the ice. He gets it all the time. You can't wait to get it the next time. Like the goal he scored, the second one last night. He gets that pass in the slot. And as I said, I don't know where the Buffalo guys went, but you never get that kind of time. He took the pass from Polak. He turned around, and I think he thought he had to shoot it right away, but then he took two more strides and shot it. The crazy part of that was, and this is the part I mean about thinking you're going to score every time you get on the ice, he came on the ice for the goalie. Like everybody else had been doing all the work out there. He shows up on the ice. I think he was there probably 5 seconds. And turns around and, oh, would you look at this? I'll move in two more strides and boom, it's in the net. It's the most awesome feeling.
Yeah, and then in the second period, I mean, he's right up in front of the net there, and Mitch Marner, who is in fuego himself, setting everything up, finds Van Riemsdyk right in front of the crease, and he just flips it right across to Tyler Bozak on that power play. Boom. Put it home. Again, the puck finding you.
Puck finds you, you know where the next play is, you know where the traffic is. It just feels right. I got to tell you, I mean, maybe this is nitpicking, but they're up 2 goals with 3.5 minutes left. I thought he should have been on the ice. Like, what are the chances a player is going to get to score back-to-back hat trick?
Come on, and Ray, maybe, you know the coach.
I do know the coach.
You think Mike would put him out there for that kind of situation?
Well obviously not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not the coach. I would have had him out there.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ray. And, you know, you saw what Paul Maurice did last week with Patrick Laine to get the hat trick, you know, the empty netter. Hey, I'm with you. I mean, back-to-back hat tricks, it's a rare occurrence.
Now, I know they're in a different spot, but Ottawa was playing on Tuesday, I guess it was, in Florida, and PRV had 2 goals. He was exhausted, and he tried to come off the ice, and they pushed him back on the ice. And I said in the game, this kid's going to have to learn how to cheat for the empty net here. He's playing too responsibly. Like, they were up by a couple of goals. Like, Van Riemsdyk's a good player. He's not going to cheat to put you in a bad spot. They could have played for 3 hours last night, and Buffalo wasn't going to get 2 more goals. Not a chance. I just thought that was just a simple time. Not that clearly he doesn't care about building favor with his team. But I think it does kind of matter. Now, it might not matter, and they might stampede to a Stanley Cup, and James Van Riemsdyk might sign in Toronto. Or you might get to July, and he goes, you know what, I'm tired of playing 15 and a half minutes a game. And, oh, yeah, I remember that night when I could have had back-to-back hat tricks, and I didn't get on the ice. Don't think it doesn't matter, because it all goes into the hopper about, do I like it here? Do I like my role? Do I like where the team is going? Do I like the money they're offering? Do I like the term I'm offering? It all goes in together. And not that you have to buy favor, but I thought last night was an easy one. And maybe that's nitpicking, but I thought it was an easy one.
No, I agree with you. I mean, Tyson Nash down in Arizona just told the story about how Joel Quenneville got him his bonus, and Joel's legendary for coming down at the end of the near the end of the season to find out what everybody's bonuses were and trying to find a way to make sure they could get their bonuses. So
now, I wasn't in on the story. How the hell did Nasher get a bonus?
Yeah, well,
what was that for? 173 dumps off the glass?
Yeah, well, it had to be for some type of clearing or something like that, right?
But Joel, so I can tell you a quick story about Joel is when he was coaching in St. Louis, I was in Los Angeles, and we were playing a game, and Noodles was playing. Noodles was actually in goal for St. Louis. And I forget the two players, Scotty Young. Oh, it was Pavel Demitra and Scotty Young. And they both had a bonus. They needed one more point each. And the net was empty. And Demitra went down Joel had them on the ice at the end of the game, you know, clearly to go for the empty net because they were up by a couple. And Demitra got it, passed it across to Young. He had a wide open net. And we had just called Yaroslav Modry up from the minors. And Young goes to shoot it. And Mo makes this sliding, diving, unbelievable block. And our whole bench was like, no! Like it was the last game of the year. Like, poor Mo. He's just trying to do the right thing. Everybody else but him knew that this bonus was happening. And he blocked it. And as it turned out, the Blues ended up giving Demitra and Young half of their bonus. Even though they didn't get it, they fell 1 point short.
Talking about making guys happy, or at least going half the distance to fulfill. Yeah. I mean, before we get you out of here, Ray, a thought on JVR and what the Leafs do. Is it a lock that he walks? Because I always go back and forth in my mind on this, which is the one thing that hasn't happened with the Leafs yet, because they haven't really, at this point, had to encounter it, is they haven't gotten locked into one of those 7 or 8 year contracts with a UFA who's going to spend most of that contract on the other side of 30, and you're left kind of going, geez, you know, that's a tough cap hit. Like a Lucic in Edmonton, for example, and I always pick on him, but that's the one that comes to mind. Is there a way he fits in terms of term and dollar, or is it a lock that he's just out the door?
Well, I guess, Scotty, it depends on what else is sitting out there. Now, if somebody offers him 7 years at $7 million,
goodbye,
then I think he's out the door. But if he doesn't have that type of offer, and I think those offers are going to be more and more difficult to come by. Slowly, management seems to be coming to their senses about offering somebody that long a contract, in particular at the age that we're talking about. Now, it only takes one team to offer him, and then Toronto's got a problem. Like the way I'm looking at this, and maybe I've got this a little wrong, but I see there is a way that they can keep Van Riemsdyk. And if I were Toronto, I'd want to, because I think he's a really good player who fulfills, you know, a very valuable role. He's shown that he can be productive wherever you put him in the lineup. He doesn't need a whole bunch of minutes to do it. So if you look at Bozak and Komarov, I think between the two of them, they make $7.2 million. So they're off the books next year in my world. So you let them walk, and there's $7.2 million that's available. If Van Riemsdyk's at 4.5, if you can get him at 6.5, that's only two of the 7.2. And so now you've got $5.2 million to look after William Nylander, who's an RFA, and address potentially replacing Bozak and or Komarov, or whether you think you've got enough from the American League to at least start the season and see what you have. So I think it can be done.
But,
and so if you just play that out a little bit, and Jonas would know this because, you know, Jonas would have, I would say you and Masters would know this by extending out the contracts. The next year is the second year of the big money to Marlowe. And then technically that third year, they can do just about anything they want with it. Hainsey would be off the books. Gardner's contract's up, so you'd have a decision to make there. Like, there is some flexibility with the Leafs for the next little bit before they get into the real big money of Marner and Matthews.
All right, Ray, we know you got to rock and roll. We'll pick this conversation up without you. Great to chat. Hazy will be back on Monday, provided he's allowed back across the border.
Well, we'll hope so. And by the way, before I go, Jonas, just so you know, Chris Cuthbert and I were having lunch or having dinner with Masters yesterday, and I think there's an appeal that you guys could make based on one of your answers.
From last
Yes, from your second defeat.
Interesting.
And if not, Cuthbert and I are prepared to tackle those two knuckleheads in one of these contests.
Did Mark make you aware of this? Can I ask that?
Masters was griping about it on my show to me yesterday.
Yeah, he's a little. He says, I don't want to come off like a complainer. And we're like, it's too late, Mark. You already are complaining. And so he views this. He's not even sure who he would cheer for. And that is a little upsetting.
Well, oh, come on.
The other thing that's...
Because he views Cuthbert as a mortal enemy because of the information that Mark's wife was flying in coach and Mark was in business.
Well, the other thing that's weird, Ray, is Masters apparently has been hired by O-Dog to help O-Dog prepare for the next Trivia Showdown. And I said to Masters, why is the guy who beat you twice hiring you to help him? Shouldn't it be the other way around?
Except, let's be honest. I think the greatest answer was 1856. Was that the year he used? When was the Constitution written?
Yeah. That's the best. My favorite was, my buddy's hiking it right now. Machu Picchu's in India. That was the best.
Loved I think it. That football helmet is too tight on him, and I don't think Masters could possibly help him.
All right, pal. It was a blast as always. We'll do it again soon.
Guys, enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you.
You bet. Ray Ferraro on Overdrive, brought to you by Valiant Financial. For fast approvals and competitive payment options on heavy equipment from any dealer, visit valiantfinancial.ca.